Bill Nye, reel number 4.
Captain Egorov flew solo quite successfully, and so I said, well, now it's all yours. And he said, ah, yes, tomorrow I will go to the front, to Astrakhan, and have to say goodbye to you. So I said, well, we'll fix you up with bombs and all that. And he said, oh, I don't want that. We've got plenty of bombs up at our base there, Astrakhan. And off he went. And for 36 hours, he bombed everybody and everything around Astrakhan, as far as I can gather. And then there was an unfortunate incident. The bomb went off in the aircraft, and that was the end of him. And we learned afterwards that apparently the observer was carrying the bombs in his lap, and pulling out the safety pins with his teeth and throwing them over the side, but it didn't work very well.
How competent an aviator,
he was very good indeed. But poor chap, I was very sorry that he got killed, and there was a memorial service held for him in the local church, which we attended, a very hot day, and I put on my one and only pair of respectable slacks, and as we entered the church, we were given a wax taper to hold. Then we knelt on the floor, which apparently had been a lot of memorial services before us, because there was about an inch of wax on the floor. And in the heat, we sank steadily through this layer of flax, of wax, and that ruined our only decent pair of slacks. And that was the end of poor Egorov.
Now, you would have to go back to Petrovsk,
we didn't go then, because we had no communication. We were just waiting, literally, to be rescued.
Right.
But in the meantime, the local potentates invited us to a banquet at the town hall, and our Dutch friend, who we were living with, said, well, you won't be allowed to come away sober, and it's going to be a pretty good party. Well, we arrived in this more or less derelict old town hall, and these bearded old Cossacks with all their tsarist's epaulettes and swords and all the rest. Fortunately, there were no quickies before dinner, but as soon as he sat down, the chap came round with a glass of vodka, and you had to knock it off straight away. Well, before we'd had anything to eat at all, there were about four of these, which we afterwards discovered were made out of 96% potato alcohol. And I eventually managed to get hold of a bottle of red wine to still keep the flag flying, and we had the first course and the second course. Then half a dozen of the Russians got up with a glass, apparently red wine, singing for He's a Jolly Good Fellow, or for those that effect. And there was a senior officer they gave to me first, and I knew what to do. I had to stand up, swallow the lot, and invert the glass. And as this stuff went inside me, I realised it was half this appalling vodka and equally bad brandy, with only a colouring of red wine. So I then made a very long speech while I was still good, and told them what jolly good chaps they were, and that was that. To cut a long story short, when the party broke up at 2 o'clock, the four Englishmen were all still in their feed. Such Russians who hadn't gone off with the waitresses were under the table, and so we thought we kept the Union Jack flying fairly well.
How long was it before you were picked up again after having completed your work here?
As far as I remember, it was about a week before the ship came up, and we then went back to base at Petrovsk. Shortly after that, the whole unit packed up. We once again collected a train and cleaned it out. And we left Petrovsk northward bound this time, going back through Ekaterinodar to the Black Sea port of Novorossiysk.
Could you tell me what you can remember about the circumstances and the timing of the evacuation from Petrovsk?
I don't really remember very much about it, except that it happened very shortly after we got back from the trip to Gurjev.
It's about the end of October.
No, the beginning of October, yes. I would think. And we left all our equipment there because it was not worth taking home. We gathered up a train, and perhaps the highlight of the trip was seeing our wing commander being kissed goodbye on both cheeks by the local general, almost cheers from the troops. And then we trundled across northwards through Ekaterinodar, where there are very wide open plains, which for miles and miles you can see nothing but sunflower seed. They grow the sunflower for oil. And we finally ended up at the Black Sea port of Novorossiysk, which was absolutely stuffed with British military equipment, warehouses full of army boots, uniforms, hundreds of guns of all calibres up to 6-inch, and so on.
Could you describe that scene a little more fully for me? The scene at Novorossiysk. Novorossiysk.
Well, all around the port there were big warehouses, and you could, the size of a reasonably fairly big aircraft hangar, and they're all absolutely full of military equipment of all every conceivable sort. I didn't see hand weapons, but I did see all the sort of uniforms and that type of thing, and there were tanks galore, hundreds of tanks, hundreds of guns.
British equipment.
Mm. And of course it all should be shortly after it fell into the hands of the Bolsheviks. And then we, I think there was a ship actually waiting for us at Novorossiysk. I can't remember now. I don't remember what the ship was. And we came down to Constantinople, where the unit was put ashore, and we were in a camp just outside the city.
Hmm. And, now, you spent a fair amount of time at Constantinople on this return trip.
Well, I did, personally, yes. Because I was unfortunate. I went down with a bad go of malaria, and I was in hospital for about a fortnight. Then I went over to the island of Principe to recuperate. It was very pleasant. And from there, I used to do day trips back to Constantinople, and I went round all of the mosques and the other main sites. But the place I liked most of all were the old Turkish bazaars, where you go and sit in a shop, the shopman would call you in, and regale on Turkish coffee, and you just sat there. You didn't have to buy anything.
Yes.
But you could see the whole of the world go by, practically every race under the sun. Mm.
What's particularly interesting is that Constantinople was the capital city of one of the major defeated powers at the end of the Second World War. How apparent was that fact of their defeat? How apparent was that to you at that time?
Well, by then, you see, it was 10 months after the end of the war, and they seemed to recover fairly quickly. There was a lot of poverty, I think always has been, in Constantinople. And there wasn't much in the way of, certainly other than local goods to buy. But they seemed to be, most serviceable trams were working, most other services seemed to work. And it was quite a going concern.
Mm. So the civilian authorities seemed to have got life moving
fairly
effectively.
They got it pretty well under control, I think.
Yes. What was the reaction of the people to you as a military officer, as a British officer?
I didn't sort of have any official contacts, but they all seemed to be perfectly friendly. And in fact, these old chaps in the bazaars were always very friendly, I would say.
So traitors first and enemies second.
Yes, I think so. But they never pressed you to buy, which is strange in the Orient.
Very courteous, at
times. They didn't press you at all. You just sat there and had a cup of coffee, and that was it.
Could you tell me about getting away from Constantinople? What were the circumstances of your departure?
Oh, yes. About 4 or 5 days after I'd been past fit, during that period I'd been living in the officers' club, I reported to the only remaining RAF officer in an official capacity at Constantinople, who knew nothing about me at all. He'd come from Salonika, and he told me more or less that I'd go home when he felt like it. So I went back to lunch in the club somewhat despondent and met a kite balloon officer who I discovered was in the same situation. So I said, well, I know one of the military landing officers slightly. Let's go down this afternoon and see what's doing. So he went to see this chap, and he said, oh, yes, fine, there's the sloop Honeysuckle sailing at 5 o'clock this afternoon for Malta. And we had to go for Malta because we'd applied for permanent commissions. So we got down to the quayside about 4:30, our bag and baggage, we rowed out to the sloop. And as far as I know, the other RAF, the official RAF officer in Constantinople, still looking for me.
It surprises me that you could spend 7 months in South Russia and yet have so little contact with the White Russian armies that you were supposed to be there supporting. Could you explain that, why that should be?
Well, in Petrovsk, there was... I suppose there were some Russian army units, but it was very difficult to spot them as opposed to the ordinary population. And in the little park that I mentioned, where you used to see people parading in the summer months, you did see a few Russians, but we had no contact. I think sort of military formations were a good deal further north. These are odds and ends. As regards social contacts generally, I never went into a Russian's house the whole time I was there, simply because the whole social structure of the country and the whole had been completely ravaged. And the only real meeting with any Russians was at this famous dinner party in Guriev. Mm.
What was your impression of the value of the reconnaissance operations your squadron was carrying out around the Caspian, the military value to the White Russian armies?
Oh, absolutely none. I think the whole of this South Russian army of occupation was just a complete political nonsense. Nothing more or less. Waste of time, money and everything else. I suppose it kept a few of us from cuttering up the unemployment bureaus at home. But that's about all.
So you feel you made no positive contribution to the military operations at all?
Absolutely not. Mm. Mm.
And did you ever, in fact, meet any Bolshevik air units?
No, fortunately.
So never fired a gun in anger?
No. Oh, yeah, right, only at ground targets.
Yes. One other thing I'd like to ask you. The volunteers, of course, were made up of units of other nationalities than British. Did you meet any other nationalities amongst the volunteers?
No, there were only British in our area. Mm.
I see.
Navy and the Army Protecting Unit, yeah. Indian Army. And the Air Force units.